A Tilt with the Muscovite, George Bronson Howard. Chapter 1. The Letter from Paris. No matter where York Norroy might go, the messages sent by the Secretary of State always followed him. They were commonplace enough in wording, were signed simply with an initial, and were sent through the usual channels of the Western Union office. The boy assigned to the delivering of this particular message had followed Norroy from the Metropolitan Club to the secret agent's apartment on Connecticut Avenue, and from there had perforce to transport his small person to the golf links at Chevy Chase. Norroy never lost time in answering these summons, and that was his excuse for appearing in golf tweeds and tan shoes with long, loose coat and slouched hat. He removed the latter two articles of attire on entering the secretary's residence, and when shown into the private library, lighted one of his ever-present cigarettes with the gold crest, and waited the new detail. He was quite ready for it, as 2 months spent in enforced idleness was quite enough for him at one time. They shook hands on the secretary's entrance, but the head of the Department of State made no comment further than to request that Norroy read a letter written in French, which he put into his hand. "It's rather badly put together. Ryder isn't a Frenchman," observed Norroy when he had glanced over it.
"Translate it aloud," directed the secretary. "I have the gist of it, but I imagine your French is better than mine."
"To the Chief of the Foreign Office, Washington, United States of America. Sir, if you would know what has become of Monsieur Leo Gaylord, about whom your newspapers said so much 2 years ago, you can discover what you wish to know by sending someone to Paris and have him write to Monsieur Anton Dumercier, 16 Faubourg Saint-Grégoire. I cannot tell more by mail, as I am not authorized to do so. This is a most serious thing for Mr. Gaylord, as he is being held a prisoner by an European power for certain reasons unnecessary to explain to you. When you receive this, please telegraph me immediately when your agent will be in Paris. With much respect, your obedient servant, A.D. Paris, November 6th. Translated out of idiomatic French into idiomatic English, that is about the size of the letter, remarked Norroy, as he returned the paper to the secretary.
So I thought.
The secretary took from the pocket of his coat a number of newspaper clippings.
You had better read these at some time. They will be useful to you.
Am I to go to Paris, then? Questioned the secret agent. The secretary nodded.
You know about this man Gaylord, of course. Everyone does, thanks to the press. But there are two things that for 2 years you have not known, along with the general public. The first is this. To where did he disappear?
Norroy flicked some ashes from his cigarette.
Pardon me if I suggest that you are also in the dark concerning that, Mr. Secretary.
That I grant you. I am. But on the second point I am fully informed. You are well aware of Gaylord's ability as an inventor and of the many astoundingly clever devices he placed on the market, making a fortune for himself out of them. Now, for 4 years before his disappearance, he had been at work on a gun, a rapid-firing gun, of tremendous power which would carry the almost unbelievable distance of 25 miles, fired from a ship.
Norroy seemed on the point of whistling, so great was his surprise. He did not, however, but his slender fingers beat a rapid tattoo on the table.
You can readily understand what such an invention would mean to naval warfare. 25 miles. It would render practically useless the navies of other nations.
But was it practicable? Inquired Norroy.
That we do not know. Gaylord went away from the United States to work on it, received a concession from the Secretary of War to utilize one of the islands in the Samoan group for the purpose of testing his invention. He refused any assistance in the way of skilled helpers, and went there to work by himself. 2 years ago, he appeared in Tutuila and wired the Secretary of War a message to this effect. Have completed model. Tested it. Found it practicable. Destroyed it. Proceeding to United States via Europe. Need rest. Will confer with you in Washington 3 months' time. Probably utilizing naval gun factory purposes of building.
The secretary had been reading the quotation from a notebook in his hand. He closed the book and replaced it in his pocket.
That sounds as though he had succeeded, remarked York Norroy.
We heard from him again from Hong Kong, from Cairo, and from Vienna. His next place to stop was at St. Petersburg. He is supposed to have never arrived there. The clippings and the detective reports will tell you all you may not know, but which has been brought to light. Perhaps Anton Dumercier may be able to supply the missing links.
Noroi rose, and the secretary also.
Remember, Noroi, the importance of this affair is without parallel. I do not think we have ever had any case on our hands which caused as much sleepless nights as has Leo Gaylord's. Imagine a gun that would destroy at 25 miles in the possession of any European power. It would mean the supremacy of the sea, the absolute supremacy. And what would be the result?
There was no need for either man to answer the question. Both understood perfectly what the mission meant.
I shall go to New York tonight and take the Luciana tomorrow. You will hear from me in 6 days from Paris.
And remember, were the secretary's parting words, spare no expense and no effort to glean every atom of truth from Dumercier, or whoever wrote that letter.
The hard lines around Noroi's mouth were excellent reasons to believe that no such instructions were needed to exert him to his utmost in this case. The large, fair-haired man with the military carriage hesitated at the entrance of the café of the Hotel Continental, and his eyes roamed about the low-ceilinged room as though he were in search of someone. Presently, the vision of an elaborately attired boulevardier in frock coat and tall hat was mirrored in his orbs, to the exclusion of the other patrons of the café. For the letter had said that the representative of the United States would wear a yellow chrysanthemum as a boutonniere. Such lapel decorations being rare in Paris, Monsieur Dumercier hesitated no more. He approached the table and stood before it, regarding the man with the chrysanthemum and the rimless monocle.
Comment vous portez-vous, monsieur?
He inquired with respect.
Très bien, merci, monsieur,
was the calm reply.
C'est monsieur le maire?
Asked the fair-haired man tentatively.
Oui, monsieur,
replied the monocled one with brevity. It was sufficient introduction, and the two men studied each other over the foaming box which the garçon brought them at the command of the one addressed as Le Maire. The conversation was mainly on the weather and the recent turmoils in the Senate. By Dumercier's speech, it was easily told he was not a Parisian. The average listener would have decided he was from one of the lost provinces. Le Maire, too, had a slight accent which proved him not of the boulevards, but which might easily obtain with a native of Languedoc or perhaps Gascony. They did not linger long in the café, but adjourned to Le Maire's apartments on the second floor of the hotel. No words were wasted between the two on the way. Le Maire threw open the door of his private reception room and bade Dumercier enter. The door was locked, and both men went into the bedroom adjoining, Le Maire closing the second door as they passed in. From his pocket Le Maire drew a letter which he handed to his companion.
"You wrote this?"
he inquired. The other replied in the affirmative.
"Well?"
It was easily seen from Le Maire's manner that he expected to share little in the conversation and that he did not intend to draw it out to the extent of a personal chat.
"I am a Pole, Monsieur Le Maire,"
began the other, apologetically almost.
"And I was an officer in His Imperial Russian Majesty's army. I am not now. I was lucky to escape unharmed. That is all regarding myself that I need say, is it not?"
"Unless it concerns Monsieur Gaylord, yes."
"Well, Monsieur Gaylord is in a Russian prison. He has been there for 2 years. That was news to you until my letter came, was it not, monsieur?"
The other nodded.
"I was a sergeant in the Polonskis when he came. Afterward I became an officer, but no matter. How I came to discover what I know is also no matter. Briefly, I will tell you. Monsieur Gaylord was arrested near Moscow, and he is now a prisoner but a few versts from that city, in the fort of St. Basil. They did not intend to keep Monsieur Gaylord prisoner for long. They thought to find on his person some sketch or plan which would tell them about the new cannon which he had invented. But there were no papers of any kind on him or in his bags and boxes. Therefore he was taken to St. Basil. He might have been free the next day after his capture if he had given up his ideas to Monsieur Mobrikov. But he would not. Monsieur Mobrikov is chief of the Bureau of Engineers and Ordnance. It was he who knew that Monsieur Gaylord had completed his new gun, which he would make for the United States. When Monsieur Gaylord refused to tell him how it was done, he told Monsieur Gaylord that he should remain prisoner until he did so. A prisoner, then, he has been for 2 years, but nothing would he say. 3 months ago, Monsieur Mobrikov, who is also a colonel and a noble of Russia, a count, made up his mind that Monsieur Gaylord should tell what he knew. So Monsieur Gaylord was ordered to be knouted if he would not tell.
The teeth of his listener came together with a savage snap, and he crumpled the letter in his hand into a shapeless mass. The man who called himself Dumercier looked up quickly. His audience had begun to straighten out the paper and was now tearing it slowly to pieces.
"Proceed," he commanded.
"So Monsieur Gaylord was knouted. You know the knout, monsieur. It is long and has brass ends to it. With this, Monsieur Gaylord was scourged. 50 strokes he received. But he would not tell what they wished to know. The count then said that each week would the knout be given to him. But he would not answer. He only closed his mouth, as you did but a moment ago, closed his mouth and ground one tooth against another. And what he said was in your English tongue. The language I do not know, but so many times has Monsieur Gaylord said this that I have learned it too. 'Gotterelle,' he said. Only that, no more. 'Gotterelle!' Now as for me, I was foolish. I was an officer. I was a noble too then, for one may not be an officer without he be noble. But Poland, they wish to be free there. And I, but that is concerning myself, monsieur, it only serves for you to know that I determined to leave Russia before it was so arranged that I might never leave it. Monsieur Gaylord I liked. I went to him. I told him that I was coming out of Russia. So then he told me this. I dared not write it down, for I knew I might be searched, but this I learned from him and repeated it again and again. I have been beaten like a dog and caged like a criminal. I love my country, but if my country cannot aid me, or will not, I must aid myself. As yet Russia knows nothing of my new weapon. 3 months from today, if I am not free, she will know all."
The paper in the hands of the other had been reduced to the tiniest fragments. He looked up.
"That was all?" he inquired.
"All except that if I succeeded in carrying the message, the person to whom I gave it should pay me 10,000 rubles and collect the same from his brother, Douglas Gaylord of Birmingham, Alabama. If he were freed, 10,000 more he would himself pay me."
"This man Mobrikov, what of him?"
"I have told you. He is a noble and a colonel in the army. He is the chief of the engineers of the ordnance. He has Romanov blood."
They talked more. The monocled one asked many questions, searching questions which went into the history of Mobrikov's past career and all those connected with him, his likes and his dislikes, his habits and his manners. There was a satisfied gleam on the questioner's face when the information was elicited that Mobrikov's failings lay in the direction of women.
"Ah, yes," the Pole said, "the chanteuse of the Palermo. They indeed are the favorites of Monsieur Mobrikov. To one he threw 1,000-ruble note. I was there, monsieur, for a girl from my village danced. Afterward she told me. It is that, monsieur. Stage women. I know not why he seeks his feminine society among them."
He was cut short by the other rising.
"There is a note for 500 francs, Monsieur Dumercier," he said curtly. "I will see more of you again. I will write you. Meanwhile, I must think."
"But the 10,000?
"All in good time. I must see for myself. I go to Moscow tonight. But have no fear. It is but a trip of inspection. I will return before the week is out. Au revoir, monsieur."
He saw him to the door and then sat down in the reception room. For some minutes he sat perfectly still. Then he lighted a cigarette and after that, many more, his slender fingers meanwhile drumming a devil's tattoo on the arm of the chair in which he sat. That evening, the 6 o'clock express for the north bore the person of Monsieur Le Maire, described in his passport as a French-American, occupation the management of theaters, residence New York City, and object in visiting Moscow, business connected with the theaters. The passport was signed by the Minister of the United States to France. In Moscow, Monsieur Le Maire remained several days. He exhibited a tourist's curiosity with regard to the old city. Monsieur Mikhailovich, the manager of the Café Chantant, the Palermo, gratified this curiosity personally. In his company, Monsieur Le Maire visited the Kremlin, the Cathedral of Ostankino, the Church of the Nativity, and that weird architectural monstrosity, the Church of St. Basil the Beatified, with its forest of bell towers ornamented with heraldic designs, pots of flowers, and many grotesque figures. Naturally, from the Church of St. Basil, it was not strange that the mind wandered to the prison of the same saint. So thither they went too. Monsieur Le Maire seemed to take but little interest in the grim criminal institution, so they remained but a short while. When Monsieur Le Maire left Moscow and Monsieur Mikhailovich, he promised the proprietor that his chanteuse would arrive within several weeks. Whereupon Monsieur Mikhailovich smiled in a gratified manner, soon afterward conferring with the disreputable journalist who aided him in his work when he was not overfull of vodka. The disreputable journalist wrote a sonnet which exalted the beauty and ravishing charms of certain English and American singers who would delight the inhabitants of the Kitai Garod with ballads sung in Monsieur Mikhailovich's charming resort, the Palermo. This sonnet was published in the newspapers of Moscow and was read by noblemen and officers of the Navy and Marine who sojourned within the Kitai Garod. These exalted personages were frequenters of Monsieur Mikhailovich's Café Chantant. Consequently, they were interested. Meanwhile, two cablegrams had been dispatched by Monsieur Le Maire as soon as the train left the realm of the Great White Tsar. Both were in code, and the German telegrapher who handled them scowled, for such messages were not liked in His Teutonic Majesty's realm. But they were dispatched nevertheless. One was to the Secretary of State, and requested that Miss Adelaide Hardesty be ordered to Paris immediately to join Theophile Le Maire at the Hotel Continental. The other was to Miss Hardesty herself, and is perhaps worth quoting. "Secretary wired today request for your assistance. Select 3 prettiest showgirls in Manhattan. Bring them with you. Consult secretary regarding reasons." Thus Edna Follis, Mabel Dupree, and Nanette Edmonds forsook the Rialto and journeyed with Miss Adelaide Hardesty to Paris. A full letter explaining the reasons for the 2 cablegrams reached the Secretary of State by the Campagna. It bore the postmark of Paris. In part, it read, "The man who gives the information is a Polish nihilist, formerly an officer in the Russian army. If we were to take the matter up legally with Russia, his oath would not be worth the word of a Chinese diplomat. He is discredited and disgraced, and acknowledges the fact himself. To make a serious charge against another power on the strength of such a man's statement would be impossible and absurd. It would be denied, and if things came to the worst, Gaylord would probably be sacrificed and his body put into some vault of the fort. My plan seems to be the only feasible one. If it fails, be assured that I am quite aware of the fact that I can expect no assistance from the United States, officially." This screed was signed with the initials of York Noroy. Chapter 2. The Girl from Broadway. For 2 weeks, the American chanteuse had sung and danced before the critical audience which nightly gathered in the Café Chantant of Monsieur Mikhailovich. Incidentally, their twinkling feet, coquettish gestures, trim forms, and speaking orbs had caused the Odessa Jewesses and Georgian beauties, hitherto such favorites, to fill the position commonly denominated as facing the wall. Even Yvette d'Alencon, Parisian and consequently charming, was not acclaimed as of yore. The American beauties had caused her star to wane and become dim. The Americans brought ragtime with them. Moscow had heard ragtime before, but not sung as the Rialto girls sang it, nor accompanied with the complement of goo-goo eyes and buck-and-wing dances. The receipts of Monsieur Mikhailovich increased, and he one day, in an excess of jubilance, embraced Monsieur le Maire and kissed him affectionately on both cheeks, which was Russian sentiment, and meant that he cherished Monsieur le Maire as a brother. Monsieur le Maire, being French, should have appreciated this, but evidently his residence in America had deprived him of the mental light which approved of osculation between those of the same sex. As it was, Monsieur Mikhailovich narrowly missed being stunned into unconsciousness by a blow from Monsieur le Maire's fist. Monsieur le Maire, however, remembered his part and restrained himself. Back in the dressing rooms, the girls chatted amongst themselves.
"Talk about your New York Johnnies," sniffed Maybelle Dupree. "Why, they're not in it for a minute with these fly Russian guys. Say, Edie, you remember that chap that sat in that second walled-off pen last night and threw me a pearl bracelet, eh? Well, he's here again tonight. I just peeped out behind the curtain and saw him."
Edna Follis adjusted her pompon.
"You'd better leave the new ones alone and stick to the old," she said warningly. "That Captain Wishtoff."
"Weshoff," corrected Maybelle indignantly.
"Well, anyhow, he's a good fellow. You won't find many will hand you out a diamond brooch like the one he gave you. He'll be angrier than the seven Satans if you throw any eyes at the other fellow. I know."
"Victor?"
suggested Mabel pleasantly.
"Shut up. You don't know anything about Victor. Why don't you try and act as though you had some sense? Act like Adelaide. Adelaide hasn't mixed up with any smelling ruskies."
The third girl, who had been silent, now spoke.
"Adelaide is a fool," she commented. "There's that fellow who comes here every night, sends her candy and flowers and everything. I know who he is. Lieutenant Ogareff told me. He's Count Mobrikov, and he's related somehow to the Tsar's family, and Adelaide won't pay any attention to him. I believe Adelaide has a mash on LeMaire and hasn't got any time for anybody else. Can't say I like him much. Do you?"
observed Miss Follis.
"No, I don't. He's altogether too fond of browbeating people. Say, do you know I have my doubts about him being French? I heard him talking to Adelaide day before yesterday in the corridor, and he spoke as good English as you or I."
There was a rap on the door, and the call for Miss Follis was made, whereupon Miss Follis donned her light top coat over her red skirts and, taking her beribboned cane, departed to delight the souls of the children of the Tsar with the amatory strains of "I've Got a Feeling for You." There was no dearth of auditors for Miss Follis's coon song. The brass-railinged tiers of the pit had their tables crowded with men in the various uniforms of the army of the Tsar: the blue-black of the marine, the sky-blue of the infantry, the red of the telegraph, the orange of the light cavalry. All were represented there. The sight catching the singer's eye from the stage was reminiscent of a rainbow. The electric lights shone on patent leather boots, gold braiding, silver spurs, and jingling swords. The spectators themselves were mostly of the same class: army officers, naval officers, employees of the government in some shape and form, all wearing uniforms and all ready to cast upon the stage money extorted from the government as evidence of their pleasure in the antics of those who appeared before them. But there was one man in all this crowd who was immediately brought to the attention of any who entered. He sat on a raised platform, almost on a level with the stage, and it was known that this platform was one which was occupied by none save those of high rank. The man who occupied this place was attired in the uniform of Colonel of Engineers, and he wore on his breast the Order of St. Nicholas. He was a well-known patron of the Palermo, this nobleman, the Count Mobrikov. To Miss Follis, Mobrikov paid little heed, only frowning when she was recalled for the fourth time to sing over the ballad regarding the sneaking feeling. Miss Dupree, who followed her, likewise gave him no pleasure, to judge from the scowl with which he favored the inoffensive waiter on ordering his second bottle of Paul Roger. After Miss Dupree came Mademoiselle Yvette de Alencon, who was received coldly and encored but once, and that only by a few of the faithful. The entrance of the next chanteuse was preceded by loud applause and clapping of hands, for Miss Adelaide Moray, as the bills styled her, had made more than an ordinary hit with the patrons of the Café Chantant. At her appearance, Mobrikov leaned forward and watched closely, with the light of admiration in his eye, At the conclusion of her song, he joined in the applause and tossed a tiny box upon the stage. Adelaide stooped down and secured it. She was forced to repeat her song several times, but after the ordeal had been gone through with, she made her way hastily to her dressing room and opened the box. It contained a heart-shaped pin set with diamonds and rubies, around which was wrapped a note in French. A few moments later, Monsieur Le Maire and she were conversing over the note.
"Mm-hmm," Le Maire was reading it. "Scorned my advances, refused my gifts, beg interview. Wear the pin as token of acceptance."
He looked up and, speaking in English, said,
"Johnnies are the same the world over, aren't they, Adelaide?"
She nodded.
"Shall I accept? It seems to me I've held him off enough already."
He meditated.
"You have the necessary liqueurs in your reception room to satisfy his lordship?" "Considering that you sent them there, you should know. I haven't touched any of them. You know how I despise intoxicants."
"And you have the other?" She eyed him scornfully.
"Kindly give me credit for having some foresightedness."
He examined his watch. Then he looked at her thoughtfully.
"Do you know, Adelaide, you're rather a stunning-looking girl," he said.
If healthy, rounded form, milk-white skin with the faintest ruddy tinge, and deep black eyes constitute stunningness, then Monsieur Le Maire was correct. Adelaide Hardesty, or Moray, was the type of woman who appeals to the mind looking for outward charm. The finer workings of her mind were not apparent to many, for she chose not to reveal them, passing rather as a woman whose sole desire in life was to cling to the wheel of pleasure as long as life held forth within. She looked out at Le Maire from under her long lashes.
"That is part of the game,"
she returned, without the faintest show of emotion of any kind.
"I suppose your examination of your watch is a question which I am to answer. I think if you enter my reception room at the hotel at 12 o'clock, you will find the gentleman in a condition fit for our ends."
As he smiled and patted her shoulder paternally, her smile was very bitter. When he had gone, after giving a few further instructions, she became pensive.
"A good tool for his ends, that is all,"
she told herself. The bitterness was gone. There was only sadness in the whisper. When she went on for her second turn, she wore the pin which Monsieur Mobrikov had thrown to her. The eyes of the Russian nobleman lighted up, and he ordered more champagne. She watched him as she sang and threw him several looks which she strove to make unstudied. At 11 o'clock, the droshky of Count Mobrikov was at the narrow door out of which the performers passed from the stage, while within the outer room the owner of the droshky sat, rubbing his booted legs together, toying with his sword, and watching the door to Miss Hardesty's dressing room with ill-concealed anticipation. When she emerged, clad in sealskins, her masses of heavy hair adorned with a toque of the same material, he sprang to his feet. Her dark eyes fell upon him rather shyly.
"I am your slave, mademoiselle,"
he said in French, and with the customary extravagance of the Russian. He took one of her little gloved hands and pressed it to his lips.
"Almost every night for 2 weeks past I have watched you. I had thought that you were cold to me and that you preferred another."
"Merci, monsieur,"
she returned.
"But I must hurry on now. Some other time, perhaps."
"What? You will leave me so soon now that I have found you? Ah, no, mademoiselle. Ah, no. You must come with me to the Ullamen. There we will have a little supper and some wine, and I will feast my eyes upon you."
She blushed. The blush was real. Adelaide Hardesty had not yet hardened herself to playing the part which her chief had assigned her. The scraping Russian disgusted her. She knew what lay behind his flattery. She knew of the knouting of Gaylord and of other things. At the thought of the last, she braved herself to the ordeal.
"If you insist, monsieur,"
she said, smiling faintly,
"I will allow you to go with me to my hotel."
"Ah, yes. You have lifted me out of Hades into heaven. My droshky awaits without."
He took her arm, and she allowed him to help her into the vehicle. A word to his driver and they were whirling across the snow in the direction of the Hotel d'Angleterre, where Adelaide Hardesty maintained a suite of rooms. She strove to make it appear to the Russian that she was interested in him, and thanks to his egotism, her rather studied attempts passed for realities. And now the hotel loomed up before them. He stepped to the ground and helped her to alight.
"And now, Monsieur le Comte," she said as she released his hand, "I will say good night and thank you."
"You will leave me now?"
"Ah, no. Let us go within this hotel of yours. Let us have the supper of which I spoke."
He talked on more in the same strain, and presently she assented reluctantly.
"I have a reception room, Monsieur le Comte," she told him. "In that you may stay for a while if you wish. I do not care for the public dining room, nor do I care for food."
Mobrikov, delighted at his supposed victory, followed her, and after the servant had gone ahead to light the rooms, she motioned him to the elevator, which raised them to the third floor. Down the uncarpeted hall she led him to where the attendant stood, holding the door of her apartments open. The Count bowed for her to pass in, and when she had done so, followed her. He did not waste time. The man was plainly attracted by the girl, and he brought all his previous knowledge of women to bear upon her. But he would have failed even had she not known of him what she did, for Adelaide Hardesty had her own ideas of mankind, and the use of flattery did not come in as part of the character of her ideal man. But she had been an actress too long to fail in any part once she entered into the spirit of it. She had placed various liqueurs on the table soon after her entrance, and he had done full justice to all of them. She had waited to see him a trifle influenced by the intoxicants before bringing out the chef-d'oeuvre.
"You have heard of the American drink, the cocktail?"
she asked, her deep eyes turned full upon him and her red lips curving in a smile which she intended to appear tender.
"That is the drink which surpasses them all."
"Of that I have heard," he responded, "and I will never rest until I have drunk it, for is it not the national drink of Mademoiselle Adelaide's own land?"
She smiled at his lofty words, a natural smile for this, for now that she had hardened herself to what she was about to do, the Russian's extravagance was humorous to her American mind.
"You need not wait long for the cocktail, Monsieur le Comte," she said. "I myself will make one for you."
He was almost maudlin now and murmured something about Hebe and the nectar of Olympus. She took the vermouth, the whiskey, the bitters, and the lemon, making the drinks on a little tabouret with her back turned to him. Then she placed the ice within the frail-stemmed glasses and poured in the decoction. In one of them she dropped something which she had been holding in the palm of her hand and quickly broke the tiny tablet to pieces with the spoon, stirring it vigorously. Then she placed both glasses on a tiny tray with the one over which she had expended so much trouble on the Russian's side.
"Will you drink?"
she asked gaily. He reached out his hand and took the glass. She raised hers and they clinked them together.
"To Mademoiselle's eyes,"
he cried. He drank it down with every appearance of enjoyment and then threw the glass over his shoulder. It alighted on the hearth and broke into tiny fragments.
"A fitting end for a glass which has served its purpose," she thought.
And now came the hardest part of all, for the drink mounting to the Russian's head aroused all his hitherto suppressed boldness, and in the manner of his race he made love to the American girl. At first a mere pressing of the hand to his lips, with the accompanying declarations of affection. She had purposely seated herself upon a tiny chair in order that he might not come nearer. He was determined that he would take the girl into his arms. His feet were unsteady now and his head whirled. Out of the mist that enveloped him he could see only her eyes shining in the light of the shaded lamp. He rose to his feet, trying to fight down his weakness.
"I love you,"
he muttered.
"I love you."
He moved forward, still holding her hand. She rose. The latent beast in his eyes terrified her. He stretched out his arms as though to envelop her within them. But at that moment a great desire for rest overmastered him. He forgot the shining eyes.
I,
he began. Then his legs became weak at the knee, and he toppled forward, gripping the table. but his muscles were inert, and his head slipped along the polished surface, and with a crash of bottles and glasses, the form of the chief of engineers flattened itself on the floor. She stood erect, pale and afraid. Then her eyes turned to the senseless body of the man. There was no sound in the room save his heavy breathing. She looked at her watch. It was rapidly nearing the hour of 12. She sat down, supporting her head with her hands among the broken remains of bottles and glassware, the trickling liqueurs dripping on her gown. She knew it, but she hardly cared. Out of the distance, the toll of the second Tsar Kolokol, the great bell of the Kremlin, rumbled out the strokes of midnight. Then came a gentle knock on the door. She arose and admitted Lemaire.
"Successful, of course?"
"Of course," she responded wearily. "He lies there."
"Then I must ask you to go into your room, Adelaide," said Lemaire.
The girl obeyed him, leaving him alone with the man. Lemaire lifted the frame of the senseless Russian in his arms and deposited him on the divan.
"It is lucky for me that I am the average height of a man," soliloquized Lemaire. "Quite lucky indeed."
It was but a matter of a few moments before the gorgeous uniform had been stripped from the person of Monsieur Mobrikov. His despoiler opened a bag which he carried and which contained a suit of coarse brown serge. In this he arrayed the drugged officer, gathering up Mobrikov's uniform and placing it in the bag from which he had taken the brown clothes.
"Now, Adelaide," he called.
The girl re-entered.
"Where is that long wardrobe trunk of yours?"
he inquired. The girl threw back the hangings at the end of the room and disclosed one of those monstrosities which are the trial of the baggage smasher, a theatrical wardrobe trunk and property box. In length it approximated 6 feet and in height about 3. She unlocked it. It was empty.
"The drug will hold good for about 6 hours. During that time he will be safe, but after that, we had better bind him now, Adelaide."
He took some stout manila rope from the same bag he had before utilized, and the feet and hands of Count Mobrikov were securely bound. A gag was placed in the Russian's mouth and bound tightly about his head. Lemaire picked up the trussed body and placed it within the trunk.
"You have bored the air holes?" he inquired. "There are 4 on each side and 10 in the top. He isn't in any danger of asphyxiation,"
was her reply. Lemaire straightened out the knees of the captive.
"All that is necessary now is to throw in enough clothes to keep him from bumping from side to side," he said. "I should advise you to lock the trunk tonight, for he will be sensible in the morning."
Then he turned to go, but she caught him by the arm.
"Haven't you a word of praise?"
she asked brokenly. He regarded her with much intentness.
"Too much praise, Adelaide, to put into words. I know how distasteful it is to you. You are a brave little girl."
He patted her shoulder in his old way.
"But remember what this man has done. He deserves more than cramping of his limbs for several days."
She tried to be calm.
"Will you be successful?"
she asked tremulously.
"There is no reason why I should not be," he answered. "I rely on you to carry out your part, you know, and I know you will. Good night, little girl."
When she had closed the door, she stared long and blankly at the entrance through which he had passed. Then she rocked herself to and fro, murmuring and whispering to herself.
"A good tool for his ends. A good tool."
She threw the required clothes into the trunk, closed and locked it.
"After all," she sighed, "it's better to be a tool for him than—"
She did not finish her sentence. Chapter 3. Within the Prison House. A little after 12, word had been taken to the driver of the droshky of Count Mobrikov that the Count would remain at the hotel for the night, but that the droshky was to be waiting for him the next morning at 9 o'clock, when he would visit the fort of St. Basil. This message was sent from the room of Monsieur Theophile Lemaire. Within the same apartment, several changes took place between midnight and morning, and had there been an observer nearby, he might have sworn that 3 men occupied the same room. For into the room and to the bed went Monsieur Theophile Lemaire, a Frenchman with a slightly bald pate, a small waxed moustache, and heavy eyebrows. When the rays of morning sunlight disclosed the sleeper, there was no sign of Monsieur Theophile Lemaire. The snowy counterpane covered the form of a man with light brown hair, clean-shaven, and evidently of Anglo-Saxon origin. When he awoke and stood erect in his pajamas, it would not have been hard for anyone who knew him to recognize Mr. York Norroy. But York Norroy existed only during the time that he took his bath and shaved. 9 o'clock saw him standing in the lobby of the Hotel d'Angleterre, an officer of His Imperial Russian Majesty's Army whose hair was coal black and whose mouth was shaded by an enormous military moustache turned upward in German style. His eyebrows were heavy and his military cap was pulled down to shade his eyes. Evidently, Monsieur le Comte Mobrikov had contracted a severe cold, for he spoke hoarsely and his neck was swathed with a white silk kerchief. The collar of his greatcoat was turned upward to protect his throat. He lighted a cigarette and inquired in a husky tone if his droshky awaited him. On being informed it did, he went out of the hotel lobby and into the street, where his driver assisted him into the vehicle. In the same hoarse tone, he directed him to drive to the fort of St. Basil. Through the streets of the Kitai Garod and over the frozen snow, the droshky sped, its owner smoking cigarette after cigarette and gazing out on the passing crowd. Many peasants and mujiks doffed their caps and he saluted them gravely, while occupants of other vehicles called to him as they sped by. Through the Kitai Garod, into the Boloi Garod, and finally into the Zemlyanai, the droshky of Mobrikov went. The last, being the Chinese city, was naturally dirtier than either the European or the Tartar quarters, and the vehicle went more slowly on account of the slippery streets. When the Iverskaya Chasnovia was reached, the driver reined in his horses and doffed his hat to the sacred icon within the Iberian chapel, and Norroy, sitting behind him, perforce did the same. After this act of devotion, the horses started again by a swift cut from the driver's whip, dashed through the resurrection gate of the Chinese wall and out beyond the city, where a few versts away, the fort of St. Basil frowned ominously on the waters of the Moskowa. It required but little time to make the journey now, and they were soon halted by the Siberian sentinel who stood beside the first gate of St. Basil.
"It is the great colonel, Count Mobrikov,"
the driver informed him in the queer argot of the Baltic provinces, half Slav, half Teutonic. Instantly, the driver's carbine was raised in salute. The iron gates swung open ponderously, and the droshky rolled over the stones of the courtyard of the outer fort, through an embrasure, and, after several more halts and salutes, stopped in the central courtyard. The sergeant who was in charge of the guards of the inner court evidently recognized the occupant of the droshky to be the chief of engineers, for he clicked his heels together sharply and saluted. The false Mobrikov saluted the sergeant in return, alighted and walked past the line of guards, following the non-commissioned officer.
"You wish to see Monsieur le Colonel Mebrestiuski, Colonel?"
the sergeant had asked.
"Yes,"
replied the supposed colonel, shortly. He still spoke in the hoarse tone which indicated that his cold affected his throat muscles to the extent of preventing him from speaking plainly. He followed the sergeant through a succession of passages and waited while he knocked on the door of the room which held the illustrious presence of Monsieur le Colonel Mebrestiuski, governor of the fort of St. Basil. The door was opened by an orderly and Norroy passed into the room. The man with grizzled hair who sat at the desk in the middle of the room arose on Noroy's entrance and bade him the usual good morning.
"I have a cold, Monsieur Mebrestiuski,"
he replied in answer to the request that he remove his cloak.
"I fear it is getting close to my lungs."
Noroy's Russian was without flaw, but he found little occasion to use it on this mission, for Mebrestiuski conversed with him in French, as is usual between gentlemen in Russia, their own language being reserved more for the purpose of speaking to inferiors. After several inquiries regarding some matters of which Norroy knew nothing, but which he managed to answer in a discreet manner which aroused no suspicion, the secret agent asked concerning the American prisoner.
"He is violent as usual,"
answered the governor.
"He swears at anyone who enters his cell and curses the little father in terms which would shock even a hardened roux like yourself."
"I wish to see him again,"
said Norroy, cutting the governor's peroration short. The governor, frowning, rang for the orderly.
"Take the Colonel Mobrikov to the cell of the American."
Norroy followed the orderly, seemingly to the bowels of the earth. A lantern was necessary to show the way, and they plunged into dank, evil-smelling corridors where the lanterns of other soldiers, keeping guard, bobbed up and down like will-o'-the-wisps in the darkness. Finally, the orderly asked a question of one of the guards, and a huge key was fitted into a lock. A bolt shot, and an iron door swung open.
"Here is the lantern, Colonel Mobrikov,"
said the orderly with respect.
"Do you wish me to remain?"
Noroi replied in the negative, and then addressed the guard.
"Close the door, fellow. I have something to say to the prisoner in private. Close the door and bolt it."
The guard saluted and murmured acquiescence, whereupon the iron door clanged to again and the bolt was shot. Noroi lifted the lantern, and its light fell upon a mass of straw and a man lying with his back to the door, who was apparently unconcerned at his entrance.
"Monsieur Gaylord,"
he said in French. The prisoner snarled.
"Is that you, you frog-eyed coyote?"
in English. Then, remembering that Mobrikov did not understand that language, translated it into French.
"Frog-eyed son of loup garou?"
he finished desperately. The insult seemed ineffective in the tongue of the Gaul, and he racked his brain for a fitting addition. York Noroi wasted little time. He walked over to the recumbent man, who was now glaring at him, and said in very low tones and in English,
"Don't be surprised, don't cry out, and don't make any sort of noise. I am not Mobrikov."
The man stared at him in the light of the lantern, and Noroi had a chance to see the hollow eyes, the sunken cheeks, and the wasted hands.
"Not Mobrikov," he gasped. "Not Mobrikov? You are not—"
Noroi seated himself on the rude stool by the side of the straw.
"I received your message, Mr. Gaylord. I have come to get you out of this. Now, please don't ask any questions, but do exactly as I tell you."
Omitting the preliminaries, Noroi told him of the capture of Mobrikov and the way in which he had gained entrance to St. Basil. The listener's eyes glowed in admiration, and the weary, haggard look faded from them.
"We must waste no time," said Noroi. "Take off those clothes of yours as I'd take off mine."
He spoke in a whisper and immediately proceeded to disrobe. He continued to speak while in the process, and by the time they had exchanged garments, the whole scheme was perfectly plain to Gaylord. Noroi whisked off the false mustache and wig and placed them on Gaylord's face. Then, from an inner pocket, he took out a makeup box, such as is carried by those of the theatrical profession, and by the dim light of the lantern proceeded to make Gaylord's face a passable imitation of the Russians whose uniform he now wore.
"Speak hoarsely, as though you have a cold, and do not answer any questions unless forced to do so. Your Russian is execrable, and your French is worse. It will not be necessary for you to return to the governor's room. Simply follow the orderly out of this dungeon to the upper floors and then tell him to lead you to your droshky. Salute each soldier who salutes you. When you enter the droshky, simply say Hotel de Angleterre, and the driver will take you there. Dismiss him when you reach the hotel and send up one of Mobrikov's cards to Miss Moray. She knows who you are, and she will assist you and accompany you. The Grand Express leaves for Königsberg at noon. She has reserved berths in the wagon lit for you and for herself. Here is your passport, which I secured from the United States Minister for leaving Paris. It reads for Mr. John Moray, actor. You are supposed to be Miss Moray's brother. When you arrive in Königsberg, you will both go to the Hotel Zu Hohenlohe. There will be a third person in the party, but he is provided with a comfortable sleeping compartment in a trunk."
Gaylord suddenly burst into hysterical laughter as he thought of his arch-enemy cramped within the confines of a narrow box and forced to endure a railway journey in such quarters. Noroi placed his hand over Gaylord's mouth.
"Don't make an ass of yourself," he said roughly. "The rest of the scheme Miss Moray will explain to you. See that you carry out her instructions, for my life may depend on it. You understand?"
"But how will you escape?"
demanded the inventor.
"I feel like a cat leaving you in this hole. God, if you knew—"
"Rest easy," Noroi assured him. "I am no Sidney Carton. This is not a question of heroics. I have my orders to see that you are free, and this is part of the carrying out of them. I hope to see you in Washington within the month."
He raised his voice and called out in the hoarse tones which he had assumed for the part of Mobrikov.
"I have finished with the prisoner. Open the door."
Again the bolt was released and the door creaked.
"Now go,"
he whispered to Gaylord, "and be cautious, very cautious."
Gaylord pushed up the collar of his coat and, as the door opened, passed out. Noroi heard him tell the orderly to lead him to the courtyard. As the door grated back to its former place, and Noroi knew that now he was a prisoner in a Russian dungeon, it would have seemed that a feeling of unquiet would have come over him. But Mr. York Noroi only laughed softly, as was his wont, and twirled about on his finger the seal ring of the Count Mobrikov.
Chapter 4. The Plight of the Governor.
"You took great risks," said the secretary gravely, when Noroi had proceeded thus far with his narrative.
Noroi waved his cigarette airily.
"Really, I think you overrate my modest endeavors, Mr. Secretary," he replied. "I took no risks at all, strictly speaking."
He straightened the crescent of pearls in the crimson scarf which he wore, and crossed his legs, showing a pair of well-formed ankles in crimson hose and shapely feet shod in tan shoes. He was attired for the tennis courts, carried a racket in his hand, and wore a suit of white flannels. He was seated in the place where his conversations with the secretary were generally held, in that gentleman's private library. The sun streamed through the bay windows and revealed the trees in the grounds without just about ready to open their buds in the warm zephyr of a beautiful spring day. It was just a month since Noroi had taken Gaylord's place in the Moscow prison.
"However, to cut the story rather short, for I have an appointment at 3, and it only lacks 20 minutes of that at the present time, I remained in that cell for that day and night and well into the next day. By that time I was quite sure that Gaylord and Miss Hardesty were ensconced in the Zuhoenlo, so I decided that it was about time to teach Monsieur Mebrestyuski that there were other people capable of playing a high-handed game outside of his Imperial Russian Majesty's domains. Therefore I kicked up an infernal racket that brought the guard in with blood in his eye and a desire to murder me. I told him that I wished to see the governor immediately. You see, it was the day for the second knouting of Gaylord, and I had no desire to pose as a martyr for the cause, especially after having seen Gaylord's back. It appears that the governor had given instructions that if Gaylord thought better of being knouted, he was to be brought into his worshipful presence, so into that presence I was taken. The guard, being a squat Siberian and as devoid of intelligence as a hedgehog, didn't notice any difference in my appearance and that of Gaylord's. All foreigners looking alike to him, I suppose. But when I was put before Monsieur Mebrestyuski, that gentleman's face was a study. Finally, he managed to call the soldier 2 or 3 things which I wouldn't care to translate into English, and told him he had brought the wrong man. I presumed it was about time for me to cut in then. Consequently, I did. I told him that I was the only M. Gaylord in the prison, and that if he would send away his soldiers, I would explain. He was rather timorous, so he had my hands tied behind my back and then told the soldiers to leave the room. It didn't take me very long to explain to Monsieur Mebrestyuski exactly how the trick had been turned, and his cheeks got flabby and his complexion an ashen gray. I told him that if he would examine the index finger of my right hand, he would see Monsieur Mobrikov's seal ring. I further informed him that Monsieur Mobrikov was out of Russia, and that he was in the hands of my confederates, and closely guarded by Monsieur Gaylord himself. Deponent further saith that Monsieur Mobrikov will be held for the space of 1 week. If at the end of that time I do not appear in a certain city outside the Tsar's domains, there will be one Russian nobleman the less in the Almanach de Gotha. Also, M. Gaylord would immediately file his complaint against the Russian government with the United States Minister at Berlin, telling the whole story but omitting the death of Mobrikov. Somehow this method of reasoning seemed to appeal to Monsieur Mebrestyuski.
The secretary laughed.
I should imagine that it would have influenced him.
It did, and there were rare doings about the fort of St. Basil for some time after that. I assured the governor that I was a gentleman and would make no attempt to get away if my hands were untied. He untied them and gave me some vodka. He was not a bad sort, but the vodka was. Then he sent out messengers to Moscow, and before an hour had passed, I became the center of an astounding group of Ruskies. The governor of Moscow was there, and the Tsar's civil administrator, also the Grand Duke Vladimir and any number of high-ranking army officers.
They went into another room and held a consultation, leaving me to my cigarettes and vodka and the perusal of some English magazines lying about. At the end of a little time, the governor entered. It had evidently been decided that I had the whip hand. The governor said my story had been received with great surprise, that it was news to them that they were holding an American prisoner, that Monsieur Mobrikoff had stated that Gaylord was a dangerous Finnish nihilist who had threatened the life of the little father of all the Russias, that if I had come to them and told them the story, they would have released Gaylord and disgraced Mobrikoff. It was a beautiful string of falsehoods, well-constructed lies, with the local color all correct and told in the most sincere manner. The governor emphasized the love which lay between the countries of Russia and the United States, sang me that old song about Russia having saved the Union during the Civil War by sending her fleet to protect us. Hold me prisoner? Why, certainly not. They admired my courage and devotion in rescuing my friend and insinuated that I was in the service of the United States. I told them that I was not, that Gaylord was my cousin and that I was an actor by profession, that I had a Russian nurse and had learned the language from her. My name was Harold Mellon. In fact, I handed them just as intricate a tangle of untruths as they handed me. The governor finished by saying that if Mobrikoff were killed, it would serve him right, and that if my companions did not harm him, they had better warn him not to return to Russia, for if he did so, he would be given a pleasant assignment in Omsk or thereabouts, with a coal pick as his means of sustenance. Of course, I knew all this was not true, and that Mobrikoff would not be deprived of a single prerequisite of his rank and station, unless the United States wanted revenge and a scapegoat was needed. Of course, it was perfectly plain to them that they lost everything and gained nothing by keeping me prisoner, or by harming me in any way. They wanted Mobrikoff back, and they didn't want the United States to kick up any shindy. Now that they had lost the secret of the gun, they didn't care anything about me. To cut the story short, Noroy looked at his watch and replaced it, I dined that evening with the whole assortment of dignitaries, and they made a sweet attempt to get me drunk and let loose all I knew. But, boasting aside, it is a good Russian who can take more of the fiery liquor than I can, so that failed. After dinner we went to a ball at the Winter Palace, and I met many and various pretty women who enticed me to drink more. However, that doesn't matter. The next morning, to the sorrow of Monsieur Mikhailovich, I gathered up the 3 Broadway showgirls and deposited them on the express for Paris. The next train was for Königsberg, and that I took, promising the governor who accompanied me to the station in state that Monsieur Mobrikoff would arrive in Moscow at an early date. Of course, there were 4 or 5 of the governor's spies on the train, and they had the temerity to suppose that I didn't know them. They followed me to the hotel, but they learned nothing. Adelaide Hardesty and Gaylord were there, Gaylord under the name of Moray, and Adelaide also. Gaylord had 2 rooms, and in one of them he kept that big trunk. Adelaide said that it gave him great pleasure to go in there and talk to the repentant Mobrikoff. I am afraid Gaylord was a little cruel, for he kept Mobrikoff bound hand and foot all the time, feeding him with oats and black bread only. Prison fare. When I arrived, I swear I think the beggar was sorry, for I fear he had set his mind on dispatching Monsieur Mobrikoff. Of course, I had given my word, and that ended his homicidal schemes. Mobrikoff was given a plentiful meal and told to eat all of it possible in order that it might last him for 3. Then we packed him neatly into his box, put the clothes about him, gagged him, locked the trunk, and I stenciled on it in large letters, Monsieur Mebristiuski, Governor of Fort St. Basil, Moscow, Russia, and in red ink on the corner, Game, Perishable, Open at Once. The secretary burst into a hearty laugh, and Noroy arose, twirling his racket.
I should like to have seen the governor's face, the secretary remarked, and to have heard what Mobrikoff said when he was unbound and ungagged.
Mr. Secretary, said York Noroy, you have never heard a Russian when he is extremely angry. I have. Therefore, as I do not like the profane and the vulgar, I cannot share in your wish. The secretary stretched out his hand.
Well, play your tennis, York, he said paternally. You've done a good piece of work, I thank you. Come in tomorrow at 5.
Noroy's eyes had in them a glint of satisfaction. A great respect and friendship existed between these 2 men.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, said Noroy.
I rather think you're right, but you really owe me no thanks. I discovered a marvelous brand of cigarettes in a little place in Moscow, and the trip was worthwhile just for that. He offered his Chinese case to the secretary, who shook his head. Noroi lighted one himself, drew on his gloves, caught the racket in his left hand, and bade the secretary good afternoon.